Welcome to episode 71 of the Cycling Europe podcast. My name is Andrew Sykes. Now, Mark Wedgwood had always been a lover of maps, and last year, in 2022, he decided, after having given up his job, to cycle across every single Land Ranger Ordnance Survey map, from the number one in the north of Shetland to number 204 down in a place called Fowey in Cornwall. Took him 117 days, 7,300 miles of cycling, nearly 12,000 kilometres, that is, and he spoke to the podcast all about his journey. Now, you might want to have at hand an overview map of all those Land Ranger maps. You can find one on Google. Quickly go and find it, because you'll find it a lot easier to follow the conversation that you're about to hear. Enjoy.
My name is Mark Wedgwood. I live in the Peak District in Derbyshire, and I'm here because last year, 2022, I cycled through every one of the 204 Ordnance Survey Land Ranger maps in numerical order, starting at number one and working my way in sequence right through to number 204.
Okay, we'll come to that in a second. But let's, first of all, just kind of hear your backstory. Professionally, what do you do? And when it comes to cycling, have you got a pedigree when it comes to cycling?
Pedigree. I've cycled all my life, mainly for pleasure, often, you know, in interesting places. But I don't know whether that counts as a pedigree. I spent 30 years as a leadership instructor and consultant and team building and all of those people related things. But I haven't done that for the last couple of years. I had an opportunity to basically take a redundancy package and leapt at the chance, because it freed me up to have adventures. I had one.
So you're in your mid-50s. You've stopped the job that you were doing for 30 years. Are you now retired? Do you do anything else?
I do other things. I'm always very reluctant to use the R word, because I feel like I'm living a bit of an experiment, to be honest. At the moment, I am devoting a lot of time to turning my adventure into a book, actually. And I've never done anything like that before. So that's very enjoyable. And maybe it will lead to a new way of life. I'm hopeful that it could. But at the moment, it continues to be part of my experiment. And I'm traveling a lot, and, you know, trying to make the most of this gift of time that I've been granted. And so I've not long ago got back from 3 months in Antarctica and South America with my wife, which was a whole different thing and an amazing way to spend the British winter. Came home for the spring, and I'm off again in a couple of months' time to do some serious trekking in the Pacific Crest Trail in Washington State in America. So I'm not at home very much.
And in terms of the cycling, you said you've been cycling all your life. Have you done any long distance cycling, or is it a kind of day by day thing?
Prior to last year, my biggest trip would have been Land's End to Orkney was the trip that we did. And I think we took about 10 days over that and did about 1,100 miles. And that was back in 2008. So as a trip, as a joined together trip, that would be my biggest thing. I often go on longish day rides. From where I live in the Peak District, we're right in the centre of the country, and I have this sort of annual habit of getting on my bike and riding to the seaside at Cleethorpes, which is just over 100 miles depending on the route I choose, and then I have fish and chips and get on the train and come back again. So, 100 miles is something I'm very used to. I've done a little bit more than that once or twice. But big trips, no, not so many.
So what made you come up with the idea of doing this trip? Basically, you went through every single Ordnance Survey Land Ranger map in the country. And we'll talk about how you did it in a second. But what made you come up with the idea in the first place?
Good question. Well, you have to wind back a little and remember that we were in a pandemic in 2021 when I was looking for something to do because I enjoyed myself for most of the summer, my first few months of freedom, if you like, and then thought, well, I want to fulfill the promise that I made to me and to others, which was not to waste the gift of time that I'd been given. And so I needed to find the right way to use it. And that had to be something significant. And I thought maybe this was my chance to do what I kind of dreamed of a lot over the years, which was to do something really big on a bicycle. And beyond that, I didn't really know what that meant. But I knew that at the time, international travel was still quite tricky and probably not something to be making complicated plans around. So I thought, well, maybe there's something within our shores that will fit the bill. And I had at the time quite an extensive OS map collection, probably about half the country. And I think I just decided that would be a good place to start looking and thinking. And then I stumbled across an old piece of Ordnance Survey marketing literature, which was basically a map of maps. It was a sort of fold-out paper outline of Britain with all of the individual squares overlaid. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And I literally hadn't seen it for 20 or so years. It had been sitting in the cupboard. So I folded it out. It's about the size of a double bed. And I started looking at it and thinking, oh, well, that's interesting. So where have I been and where have I not been? And where have I ridden a bike? And, where have I never been at all? And I don't know, my brain just started going in different directions until suddenly I noticed the numbering system. And as soon as I noticed the numbering system, which for some reason I'd never really paid attention to before, there it was. I mean, it was there in an instant. I thought, well, that's a ride. That's a trip. And a few minutes later, I'd worked out that it was probably about achievable in a roughly 6 month period, which I thought is what I would be looking to do if I stayed at home. That's when the nice weather is. That's when the daylight is. And I can honestly say that, you know, it was only a question of when and not if from that point forwards. The idea just, once it arrived, it stayed.
Okay, so you've got the idea to do this long ride. Now, you didn't do it in one continuous thing. You didn't start at number one and then end up at number 204 all in one ride. You did split it up slightly over the course of that 6 months, yeah?
Correct, yeah. I had a marriage I needed to preserve, and I have two grown-up children who I thought I should probably see at some stage along the way as well. So no, I never set out to make it anything other than an enjoyable long bicycle ride, really. So that it, you know, I just had my own guidelines to stay within, and I thought that probably riding about 75% of the time was reasonable, because I thought that would make it still doable without, you know, being absent for some very good reasons that I needed to stay committed to. I'm part of a rock band and we had some gigs lined up, for example, and I felt that I needed to be there for those, and obviously family ties and so on. So that was a good balance, I think. And one of the things I learned was that cycling every single day probably would have taken some of the fun out of it.
Okay, so for people who aren't familiar with the way that the Ordnance Survey Land Ranger maps are organised, it starts at number one up at the top of Shetland, and then basically it goes in strips from west to east, so from left to right, across the country until you get right down into the southwest of England, where you end up with number 203, which is Penzance and Land's End. But actually, the final one for them is not Land's End. It's number 204, which is just a little bit to the east of Cornwall, by the looks of it. Oh, no, it looks as though it still is in Cornwall. You set yourself some rules for completing the rides through all these maps. What were the rules that you set?
I wanted to remain faithful to the numerical order. So, I mean, that sounds like an obvious thing. It isn't at all simple because, as you've just outlined, once you reach the bottom of Orkney, and that's map 7, you have to get across to map 8. And map 8 is on the north of the Isle of Lewis, which is nowhere near Orkney. And so you've got some, what I called unofficial mileage that you have to do each time you reach the east coast, basically. So from 8 onwards, right through to 204, I was doing coast-to-coast rides. I was going from west to east, in many cases starting on an island in the Hebrides and finishing somewhere on the other side of the country and then using whatever means I could to get back again. So that was one of my rules. My only official miles were the west to east miles, because otherwise it would have been, you know, twice the distance and probably an impossible task. And I made a lot of use of trains and ferries and a few other ways to get where I needed to be, plus quite a bit of extra cycling, especially in Scotland. But none of that counted in my numerical sequence. So once I'd got myself back where I needed to be, then the cycling began again.
Were you ever tempted just to do it in, I don't know, how many are there? I'm guessing, looking at the overview map, there might be 20, 30 perhaps lines across the country. Were you ever tempted to just to do it in discrete routes from west to east and then go back home and then go back a few weeks later and do another one and then go back home and then go back and do another one?
Not really. I think I set out to do the whole thing or not at all. That was really, you know, there's 204 of them and I set out to do 204 of them. And I never thought of it any other way.
But did you, when you ended, say, when you did number 8 to number 12, which is John O'Groats, that's kind of one line on the map. And then you would have to go back and do 13 to 17, which is 13 is the island of Lewis. And then 17 is, I can't see, but it's just that bit below Wick in northern Scotland. That could have been a separate route. And then to go back again and start at number 18 and to do it in discrete lines like that. Because you did do more than one line every time, didn't you?
Yeah, I did as much as I could before I reached a point where I needed to be somewhere else. So, you know, looking back, each of those coast-to-coast, 26 of them there were, lend themselves very well to discrete rides or adventures of their own. And one of the delightful things I think that I discovered is that there are some superb ways of crossing the country in areas that perhaps don't get much attention and people wouldn't think to do. So that was just almost an accidental discovery as I went, but I saw as the whole as being my task and not the individual parts, if that makes sense. I just took it a day at a time.
So on that first ride, the one that started up in the starting point I think was Hermanness on Unst in Shetland. Where did you finish that ride?
Well, the first piece of the adventure, if you like, was Shetland. So that's an archipelago that is very discreet from the rest of the country. And so the first day was on Unst. The next day took me through maps 2 and 3 as far as Lerwick. And then the next day we did a little bit more of mainland Shetland. And then we got on a ferry that night and went to Orkney. And that was, if you like, the next discreet piece of the adventure, which was 3 more maps. It's a little different when you're in islands because it's harder to come up with an obvious coast-to-coast route. And really, that wasn't what I was doing anyway. I was joining together the maps in numerical sequence. So they were an anomaly to what followed. And it was just a question of trying to cover as much of the ground as possible without going backwards, basically. So one of my rules, you asked me earlier, one of my rules was to not go backwards, to go forwards and not get ahead of myself either. If I was in map 10, then I wanted to be in map 11 next and not tread on map 12 by accident or go back to map 9, which is, I mean, it sounds obvious, but it's actually harder than you'd think because some of these maps are overlaid in strange ways. When you're in a place like Scotland, where there's a lot of mountains and a lot of coastline and nothing's very regular, actually the reality on the ground is often quite complicated and doesn't always want to take you where you want to be. So, you know, you have to do the best you can. There are actually maps up there that have almost no roads on them.
I hope anybody listening to this is actually looking at that overview map, because I think a lot of what we're saying here probably won't make any sense whatsoever for anybody who doesn't have that map in front of them. I Googled it and I've got it in front of me, thank goodness.
It's easily available online. Or another thing you can do is just look on the back of one of your OS maps, because that has, on the old ones, it has the whole country, and on the new ones, it has at least part of the country. It gives you a sense of how the maps join together.
Yeah. Just picking up on I appreciate Orkney and Shetland are different because they're kind of vertical, but you got to number seven. Now, you said you didn't want to jump ahead of yourself. How did you get then from number seven to number eight? Because there aren't any ferries that go from Orkney down to the top of the Isle of Lewis.
Certainly not, no. Well, this is where it turned into unofficial travel as opposed to official cycling miles. And that was whatever it needed to be. And up there, it was usually quite complicated to get from where I was to where I needed to be. So in this particular instance, it was a one-off. I had my wife with me for that first couple of weeks, and we rented a van in Wick, and we drove to Ullapool, which is where the ferry leaves from to get to Lewis, and parked up in Ullapool and put our bikes on the ferry and then did it that way. And it worked pretty well, actually. But that was actually just about the only reasonable and sensible and cost-effective way we could find to do it. We looked into all kinds of other options. And, you know, if you go by train, then you have to go from Wick down to Inverness and then across to, oh, I don't know where, halfway to Caerleon Loch Alsh, and then cycle 35 miles. And, you know, I mean, it was just, and you can't get bike spaces on the trains when you want them. And, you know, so that was the solution we found. But then the next time it would have to be something else. And it was just whatever was necessary, really. But I was officially through map seven, and until I got to map eight, you know, other rules applied.
I think there's a risk that this podcast might go on for hours because we're still only at the top of Scotland. But it is fascinating. Now, the other thing about, I'm going to stick with map number nine, that is Dunnes and Cape Wrath up there.
That's right.
And did you go up to the lighthouse at Cape Wrath?
We didn't. I wanted to, but the day that we were there, the weather forecast was discouraging. And in the end, I'm glad I didn't, because I made it across the top to where I needed to be just as the rain began. So if I'd delayed by another few hours, I would have been an unhappy person, I think. But, you know, that's a good question, because there are many places along this 7,300-mile route where I would have liked to have stayed a little longer or done something that I didn't get to do for one reason or another, often the weather, but often just the need to keep going as well. You know, time was always against me. And so I don't have regrets about that. I just feel like I've got a list of places to go back to, and it's a very long list. And now I know more about those places, and you know, I've done a good reconnaissance mission for future trips, really.
Yeah, I think you would have struggled on anything other than a mountain bike to actually get there. Going back to your rules, how do you define cycling through one of the Land Ranger maps? Can you literally just get to the border, stick your toe on whatever you deem to be within, say, map number 79, and if it's inconvenient, just kind of go into map 80 and continue from there? Or do you have to do a minimum distance? Is there a point that you have to pass? Do you need to go through the west side of the map and then the east side of the map? How do you define travelling through a map?
Well, that only was a decision that I had to make at the coasts, really. So where am I starting my coast-to-coast from? Where am I finishing my coast-to-coast? There was an element of discretion involved there, which I'll come back to. But everything else in between was just a case of joining it together in a line. So part of the challenge, if you like, was to make that line continuous and to remain within the boundaries of that particular strip of maps, which were roughly consistent and, you know, didn't do too many unexpected things. But every now and again, the Ordnance Survey throw in a curveball and you find yourself having to go up or down when you didn't expect to. But roughly speaking, I was going from west to east in as straight a line as I could manage. And the other caveat to that was I was always trying wherever possible to avoid traffic and, you know, keep the cycling as enjoyable as it could be. Now, up in Scotland, there are very, very few choices, very, very few roads to decide between. But later on in the trip, that became a very different question. And then on the coasts, well, I was usually looking for somewhere that was sticking out quite a long way to the left or right. Not necessarily the absolute extremity, because sometimes that didn't have a road leading to it anyway. And you know, whatever sort of suggested itself in an obvious way. So if there was a railhead, for example, that might make sense as a place to start or finish to allow me to continue my journey. Or possibly somewhere that was just iconic.
We will get out of Scotland in a few minutes, but there is, can I ask you about maps? This is testing your memory, about maps 15, 16 and 20. Now, the reason why you're looking presumably to find out where they are.
I'm looking over here because I've got them all spread out on the floor because I knew this would happen.
Right. Maps 15.
I know where you're talking about.
15, 16 and 20, because a few years ago, Ordnance Survey, they released some statistics and they released the information about, it wasn't the Land Ranger series, it was the Explorer series, and their least popular map was map number 440, which is Glen Casley, I think it says. Yeah, Glen Casley in Scotland. And I reckon that it's kind of the overlap between 15, 16 and 20 in northern Scotland on the Land Ranger maps. What was that like?
Very empty. Yeah, very empty. I think I have a pretty good idea where you're talking about. The left hand side, the west coast of that part of Scotland is stunning, you know, and I was discovering that with great pleasure when I was up there cycling along. But once you turn inland and start heading east, it changes very quickly. And you find yourself in this, it is very, very empty part of the world. There's very little in the way of settlement. There's no mountains to speak of. It's just, you know, rolling hills and a lot of forestry. I likened it, as I was cycling through, to areas like the Scottish Borders, if you know that area, which are, you know, again, very sparsely populated, rivers flowing through valleys. And I think the main reason people go there is to fish, as far as I could tell. So there's the odd hotel and there's the odd tiny, tiny little place, but not much, to be honest. And that probably has a lot to do with why nobody buys the map.
Well, I think after Ordnance Survey released that information, people actually did start buying that map and they started going there. So it was a knock-on benefit for the area in terms of its tourism.
I do remember enjoying the ride across there very much. And not unusually, it had been a fairly rainy, drizzly day up on the west coast. I think I'd started that day by getting the ferry over from the Hebrides back to Ullapool and then you have to ride north from Ullapool up and over a big hill, and then you cross the border and you're officially in map 15. And soon after that, that's where the road junction is, and you end up on this tiny, tiny empty road, as they so often are up there. So it's such a pleasure to be on a bike because you're on your own. You have the whole place to yourself. And that went on for miles and miles and miles. I think I probably had the wind behind me. And, you know, you just think, I wish cycling could always be like this. And so, you know, it didn't have to be the most spectacular of landscapes, but it was very pleasant. And maybe it suffers from having such amazing stuff nearby. And so people overlook the bits in between. Maybe that's what it is.
What do you know about the history of how these maps came about in terms of how long has that pattern of maps existed? And you must have been so grateful that they decided to number them from west to east rather than from east to west, because the prevailing wind would have made your journey a bit of a nightmare if you'd constantly been going from east to west.
There's no doubt about that. I was very grateful that they hadn't done it the other way, because most of the time I got help of some kind from the elements, and you know, it made it more enjoyable. There's no two ways about it, more of the time. And so, I'm happy to thank the Ordnance Survey for that decision. On the flip side, because of the peculiar idea I had, going out and back to the islands every time I wanted to start a coast to coast was a bit of a pain. I mean, I loved it, but it slowed me down. And most people, when they go to the Hebrides, start at the bottom and ride to the top, or start at the top and ride to the bottom, and that works very well. That's not what happened to me on this trip at all. So, you know, there's pros and cons to everything, aren't there? But as far as I know, they've had this numbering system more or less for as long as we've had, certainly the 1 to 50,000 maps in their current form, which is most of my life. I mean, I got to know a little more about the original history of these maps much, much later in my journey, because I had a visit to Ordnance Survey headquarters, but that was up in the 190s in Southampton. So, you know, months ahead of that. And I got to see the very first original number one map that was ever made, which was rather exciting.
All right. And wasn't...
Which is Kent.
Ah. So, okay, number one as in the first map they made.
Correct. Map one, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not the one for the...
The map one as we know it today, no.
Right, okay. Now, we are making gradual progress south. Northern Ireland is not included. I didn't realise that until I looked at the map this morning, but that obviously made life a little bit easier, because it means you didn't have to go across the Irish Sea numerous times. Were you tempted ever to include Northern Ireland independently?
Well, no, because again, the numbering system presented itself to me as a kind of ready-made trip to do. So I guess I just accepted that and stayed with it, and it was enough. Maybe though, there's a future trip in doing something similar for the island of Ireland, because I think that's how the Ordnance Survey have mapped that. So it's a separate collection of maps and a separate numbering system, and maybe an adventure for another day. But no, I'm always very careful to say that my adventure was Britain, not the United Kingdom. And actually, that's not technically right as well, because for reasons I don't know, they included the Isle of Man.
So you're getting towards the southern part of Scotland now, and it must have been a relief, because actually it gets relatively easy once you get into northern England, southern Scotland, northern England, because basically you've got these continuous lines where presumably the amount of ferry hopping is pretty minimal. Although I like a good ferry, and I think there's nothing better than a cycle journey with a ferry in between. But it must have got a lot easier.
I'll give you some numbers to illustrate what you just said. And I know this because I've just written about it in my book. I took something like 70 separate ferry journeys throughout the entirety of my trip. 62 of those were in Scotland. And I was, after 3 months, so after when I got to the end of July, basically, so May, June, July, which was in my head when I started out, that was half my trip. I was a quarter of the way through the maps. And that was as much to do with the peculiarities of the Scottish geography and the ferry timetables and, you know, and the points of departure of the boats and so on as anything else. So I just didn't get as far as fast. And then I had to catch up. And I knew that would be the case. I set out with that expectation, but it was more pronounced perhaps than I realized. And so, you know, the maths changed as I went.
Can you just run those ferry statistics past me again? How many?
70 separate ferry journeys in total, 62 of them in Scotland.
Right, so that means that you did 8 which weren't in Scotland. And I'm looking at the map now. I can only think of the Isle of Man. Where are the other 6?
Isle of Wight. There's 2 more.
But you didn't have to go to the Isle of Wight, did you?
Well, I felt like I did. You know, I mean, not technically no, but spiritually, yes.
Okay, and the other 4?
The other 4. Oh, gosh, that's a test, isn't it? There's one in Cornwall called the King Harry Ferry that takes you across the River Fowell. That was on my very last day. There's a tiny little one that I took across the River Thames when I was following the Thames path.
Yes, I think I've taken that one myself.
Yeah, it takes about 5 minutes. And let me think, 2 more. One across from North Shields to South Shields in Tyneside. And yes, Portsmouth Harbour.
Right, okay. Okay, interesting. Now, the Isle of Man, where do you get the ferry to go to the Isle of Man from?
A place called Heysham, which is near Lancaster.
Right, so that is... No, that would be okay, wouldn't it? Lancaster's in that same row. Mm. I was just thinking perhaps if you had to go from, say, Liverpool, it would be a bit inconvenient to go all the way up, cycle across there, come back down to Liverpool and then make your way up to number 96. But that sounds a bit more convenient than I imagined.
Heysham worked okay. But what you just described with Liverpool is the sort of thing I was having to do in north of Scotland.
Right. So in terms of time, you set off from the top of Scotland, from the top of Shetland on the 9th of May. When was your first cycling day in England?
Ooh, well, technically the first time... I was on a bike on an OS map in sequence in England was when I arrived in Berwick-upon-Tweed. So that, I might have to check the number, but it's about 70-ish, I think. 67, is it? Yeah, 67. So 67, we started in Edinburgh. And my official endpoint that day was a fishing town called Eyemouth, but then we had to catch a train. My wife was with me for that day as well, and she had to get a train home, and I had to get a train back to Edinburgh with my brother, where he lives. And we did that from Berwick. It's the closest station, and to get from Eyemouth to Berwick along little lanes, you enter England before you leave the map. I think Berwick's actually out of the map, but you know, you're still in England and you're still in the map at the same time. So, in fact, excitingly, we went along a lane for about 2 miles that was neither in England nor Scotland. It was the border.
Yeah, Berwick is, I think Berwick's in number 75. And it's just off the edge of number 67. Did you suffer from, certainly in the, well, anywhere north of Watford, really? The fact is that the train network in Britain is very vertical. It's very north-south. Apart from, you know, south of Watford, you then obviously have the West Country and into Wales. But north of that, it is a vertical thing rather than a horizontal thing. Was that a challenge?
I mean, you have to work with what's there. So there were certainly times when it wouldn't have served me very well. I think the way I think of it is like spokes on a wheel, and the middle of that wheel is London. So, you know, if I was trying to get from... Well, an example of a journey that I did have to do, for example, would be from Lowestoft, which is the most easterly point in Britain, to Aberystwyth, for example, which is way over on the other side. And my memory is that I took either 4 or 5 trains to get there and had to keep changing. And probably went through Norwich and Leicester and Birmingham. And, you know, it was not a straight line. But it was doable in a day, which was the important thing. And I did that sort of journey quite a few times. And I also passed through London quite a few times. And that's always exciting because you come in at one station and then you have to cycle right through the middle of the beating heart and then out the other side to another mainline station to get your next train away.
Yeah.
So I got quite used to doing that, and I, you know, I was a bit intimidated the first time, but then I thought, oh, actually, this is rather fun, and I look forward to it after that.
What was the longest horizontal strip?
13 maps, which went from St. David's in Pembrokeshire to Walton on the Naze in Essex.
So that's the longest. Number 157 to 169, by the looks of it.
Correct, yes.
And how many days did that take you?
I'll have to work this out. Where did I stay? I think I'd about 4 days, something like that.
All right, okay.
Yeah.
So what kind of distance were you doing on average per day?
I think on average it was sort of 60-ish, but I mean, that is only an average because I had a few days that were well over 100 and I had a few days that were 5, you know. It depended on where I was and what I was trying to do. But I found, you know, 60 to 70 to be a nice, comfortable distance to do with fully loaded as I was and, you know, without feeling like I was in a hurry or in danger of not getting there. And I could stop along the way to a couple of cafes and have a nice time. So that was, I think when I was doing my maths and trying to work out how long it would take me and how long I would need, I was working on that kind of figure.
And just to clarify, those are miles rather than kilometres?
Absolutely, they are miles, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you mentioned cafes. Mm-hmm. Did you have a rule, I read, that you had to stop in any open cafe?
Never pass an open cafe was my rule, which I was pretty true to. I can't say that it was, you know, religious adherence, but it just became necessary. I mean, I think in surprisingly large parts of the country, if you did pass an open cafe, you might regret it later. You didn't know when the next one was going to come along. And particularly because of the route choices that I was making to stay away from traffic and so on, you could get in trouble very quickly. And so up in the wilds of Scotland, it was an absolute must. And then later on, it was sensible. Cafe is a loose term. It might have been a pub. It might have been a roadside shack if it was all that was available. But you've got to keep putting fuel in the engine or you run out.
Yeah. I'm assuming you didn't stop at every branch of Greggs when you were cycling through big cities. But...
I'm not sure I actually went to Greggs at all.
Ah, shame on you. Shame on you. Right. How about the bike? Obviously, very varied terrain you were cycling across, probably, presumably, sometimes off-road, sometimes on-road. So how did you... I know you bought a new bike. How did you decide what kind of bike to take?
Well, I needed a bike that was going to be reliable. That was probably the most important thing. And that's why I bought a new one, because although I own other bicycles, none of them were very new and things wear out. So I, given the distance I was taking on, I wanted to feel like I would have a machine that I could rely on and not expect to go wrong for any reason other than wear and tear. And I wanted a bike that would do what I needed it to do. So I wanted it to be comfortable. I needed it to be able to carry a variety of bags and so on, and you know, I didn't have a fortune to spend. So once you start applying criteria like that, and actually at the time a big thing was simply availability, because the lead times during and after the pandemic got ridiculous, so it almost chose itself in the end.
So what did you buy?
I got a bike called a Sonder Calibri, which is the brand name used by a company called Alpkit, who are a UK outdoor equipment company. And I knew of them and I liked them, but mainly because I live in a village called Hathersage and they have a branch in my village. So I literally just walked down the road from my house and had a look at what they had, and they let me take one out for a test ride, and you know, one thing led to another.
Right, so you've got your bike. How about accommodation? Were you camping? Were you with friends? Were you hoteling? Were you a mixture of everything?
Didn't camp, and I made a conscious decision not to do that, and I'm glad, because there were too many days where I just thought, last thing I want to be doing now is having to put a tent up. But mainly because of the weight, actually. I didn't want to have to carry the extra weight. But other than that, anything I could find, really. So it varied enormously from, you know, a room in someone's house to a hostel to a pub, occasionally a little hotel or something, if that's all there was. I never knew very far ahead where I was going to stay. And one of the delightful things about this trip was I ended up staying with just about everyone I knew and quite a lot of people I didn't know, because I met people along the way, and I was reunited with friends and relatives, indeed, that I hadn't seen for decades. And that was just a delightful bonus to the trip, and something which, you know, gave it a whole new dimension and was an extremely positive consequence.
Yeah. Yeah, that aspect of it is, you don't tend to think of that, but it is the perfect opportunity. You know, all those people that you meet and you say, oh, yeah, one day I'll visit you. Or those far-flung relatives who live somewhere and you say, oh, I must come visit one day. And then, lo and behold, you decide to cycle through every map in the country and you rock up at their door and, and they say, what the hell are you doing here?
I was never going to be very far from just about anyone, really, you know. And actually, to some degree, it gave me a route choice. So I'll give you a simple example. I stayed with one of my mum's cousins in Cheshire. She volunteered at a very early stage, and so I was happy to take that up. While I was at her house, she rang her daughter and told her that I was coming. And her daughter lives in Suffolk on the coast. And I think we met when we were children. I think we did. Neither one of us could remember for sure. But other than knowing of her existence, there was no other connection. And yet when I got there, you know, just as it was turning dark in the evening in October, we got on like a house on fire. And actually, they're going to come and stay with me in a couple of weeks' time. So it's stuff like that that made the whole thing extra fun.
I know you know Rob Ainslie, who provides the music to this podcast and who is a regular contributor to the podcast. Did you stay with him in York?
I didn't stay with Rob in York, but I did ride for a day with Rob. He's a busy man and he's hard to pin down.
Yeah.
He's too busy off doing his own trips.
Yeah.
But yeah, we managed to coincide. So I had a very nice day riding with Rob. We met each other in a cafe somewhere just south of Darlington, in a place which neither of us had heard of, and rode through a very pleasant part of the country that I didn't know. So the lower Tees Valley, and then out into the Yorkshire Moors. And we went right across the Yorkshire Moors and ended that day in Whitby, which is a great place to end a ride.
Yeah, well, he's certainly an expert when it comes to certainly cycling in Yorkshire. I think he's been in every lane and every road in Yorkshire and far beyond as well.
Well, that was why I was so pleased that I'd taken him somewhere he didn't know, actually, because, you know, that's always a surprise with Rob.
Right. Did you use warm showers at all?
Warm showers?
You're looking at me as if you've never heard of warm showers.
I only used warm showers.
No, warm showers is the reciprocal accommodation sharing website for cyclists.
Oh, that. I took a warm shower at the end of every day, but I didn't use the service that you're describing now. As time went by, it became increasingly difficult to predict where I was going to be one day to the next. And I wanted to retain control of that. I suppose, you know, I just needed to be able to be spontaneous. So obviously if somebody had offered to put me up, a relative or a friend, that was wonderful. And I did my very best to be there on time, and I did my very best to, to plan that into my journey. But beyond that, I was just needing to make progress, and I had a pretty good idea of what sort of place I might want to end the journey each day based on how long it would take to get there and where I was wanting to be the following day. And you know, I would just simply be looking on the internet. Usually things like Airbnb and booking.com were useful. But I'd be looking at the cheapest available option and not being too concerned about the quality of that. Just happy to have a place to stop. Some places turned out to be fabulous. You know, I mean, that's some of the highlights of the trip were just unexpectedly delightful places that people had.
Mm. How many individual rides were there? How many day rides did you do?
According to the Ordnance Survey, who kept track of me, I think it was about 117 or something like that. But, you know, I mean, that would be going from west to east because I wasn't recording myself going in the other direction. So there were days when I was out there doing the journey, but it was simply a case of getting from east back to west. And there were times where that could take me, you know, best part of 2 days up in the north of Scotland. So it's easier to talk about the whole elapsed time, perhaps. And as you say, I began cycling on the 9th of May. Well, I left home on the 6th of May to get to the top of Shetland on the 9th of May. And my last actual day of cycling was the 28th of November, but towards the end, I was picking and choosing weather windows just to get the thing finished, really. From about mid-September through to the end of October, I cycled pretty much every single day, and I was going through a part of the country where there were no ferries and no excuses, and so, you know, that was the longest continuous stretch of riding that I did, and it was a lot.
And when did you finish in MAP 204?
28th of November was the last day I actually cycled and ran out of maps.
Right, talking of maps, well, the whole thing's about maps. But you mentioned the OS, the Ordnance Survey, and the fact that you visited them in Southampton. Were you actually carrying physical copies of the maps, or were you relying on the app that you can get on your phone?
I mostly relied on having it on my phone. I started out up in Shetland and Orkney with physical maps. And what I quickly learned was, as soon as you passed through one of them, it was just dead weight in your bags. And so I didn't really bother with any more of those throughout the trip. As much as I loved the paper versions and they defined the trip for me, it just wasn't practical. But what I did do was I had everything spread out on my kitchen table at home, and my wife would be poring over these things. And so if I needed assistance, because what I didn't have, and it was actually quite a big thing, I didn't have the bird's eye view. And because of the nature of the trip, I needed to know how to get all the way from, you know, quite a long way over there to quite a long way over there in a line, so that wouldn't give me a problem, you know, the day after or whatever. And I also needed to know that I wasn't going to cross these map boundaries that the OS defined through their 40-kilometer squares. And on the app on your phone, you can't see any of that. That doesn't exist. So I had this second pair of eyes at home, making sure that I didn't make an unforced error.
Yeah, the Ordnance Survey maps, they're almost too good quality in terms, they're physically, the paper that they print them on is really good quality paper, which is great if you're hiking, especially those nowadays, you get those plasticized ones, which are weatherproof. If you go on the continent and you tend to use Michelin maps, they're a lot thinner. They're a lot cheaper material, which are actually better for carrying when you're cycling. But Ordnance Survey maps, yeah, they're very, very good quality paper, and they do make for inconvenient maps to carry when you are cycling. But the 1 to 50,000 maps, the Land Ranger ones, they are the kind of the perfect detail for cycling, but portable to a certain extent.
I like to be able to unfold a map, you know, if I'm sitting in a cafe or something like that, and it is the ability to see that big picture. It's so much more meaningful,
yeah,
than just a little window on your phone, which you can only ever get a tiny snapshot of where you are.
Yeah, well, you mentioned there going to a cafe and opening a map up, because that's the other advantage of carrying a physical map, is that wherever you go, whether you're camping, whether perhaps you're in a hotel, you're in a bar or a restaurant or a cafe, you open up a map and invariably somebody will come up and either give you advice or ask you if you're lost or tell you something about the map that you're looking at. And it's a really good way of actually starting conversations.
You can share a map as well, a proper one, a paper one. You can't really do that over a mobile phone. Mobile phones are more like conversation stoppers, aren't they, rather than starters.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I think they're wonderful things, and I've loved them all my life and slowly accumulated quite a lot of them, because I would use a visit to a new place as an excuse to buy a map. And I suppose a kind of ambition that I've always held was to own all of them, all 204. But I don't think I ever really allowed myself to buy them without having a good reason, so I wouldn't own a map if I hadn't had a meaningful encounter with the part of the country that it describes. And as a result of that, it probably would have taken me a lifetime to have actually completed the set had I not done something like this. And I have to give credit to the Ordnance Survey at this point, because when I'd finished, they sent me all of them in the post. So I do now have that ambition fulfilled, which is a lovely gift.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. I stayed with somebody in Bristol a few years ago. I've met him on a walking holiday. He was chairman or president of the Mountain Bothies Association. Simon, he was called. And he, when I stayed in his house, he had a complete set of the old style ones, the ones that they published in the 60s, 70s, and then also a full set of the kind of the modern version as well. And I remember being very jealous of the fact that he had this on his bookshelf. But physically, how much space do they take up? You must have a pretty sizable bookcase to keep them all on.
That's a work in progress. Physically, they required three separate large cardboard boxes to arrive at my house in. So it gives you an idea. Well, I do know, because there's a couple of outdoor shops in my village that stock the whole thing, and as I was preparing for the trip, I used to go down there and stare at them a little bit, and maybe take a couple out and try and work out my route. It's an extensive amount of shelf space.
Those local bookshops, they missed a trick there. They should have identified you as the bloke who's about to cycle through all the maps in mainland Britain, and they should have given you the hard sell to try and buy them before the Ordnance Survey actually gave you the maps. But anyway. There must have been some maps where, and I'm thinking particularly now perhaps about places like Snowdonia, where you basically had two choices. You had the choice of taking the hard route up into the mountains and then back down on the other side, or presumably there was an easier route that took you, for example, on the coast, which was a lot flatter. How did you decide, and did you prefer the challenge of the more challenging routes rather than the easy routes that you could have taken?
I think my number one rule was always to try and avoid traffic. So, I would have an idea of where I needed to be, which dots I was joining together, if you like. There were sometimes choices to be made, and I would nearly always go for the one that would give me the greatest enjoyment, and that would usually equate to the quietest roads. So, and also, if there was a particular place that I'd never been or I wanted to see on the way, then that might sway me as well. I was never that far away from where I'd just been that I wouldn't get another chance. Let's take an area of the country, Mid Wales, for example. It happens to be a place I knew very little about. Well, I crossed it three times. It's big enough to have three opportunities as you go coast to coast. So, I felt like I got to know the place quite well. To be honest, one of the nice things about this trip was that pretty much wherever I went, I was going to have a good time. So I didn't worry too much. What I didn't do was deliberately avoid hills. And that's because after the number of days of cycling that I'd done, they ceased to become a problem. I became very pleasingly fit, and my legs would just respond. And so I could just pretty much get myself over whatever was necessary in a way that I was not used to. And that, you know, that took away a lot of the discomfort, if you like, that maybe you associate with hill climbing. So some of my days, not necessarily in the places you would think either, some of the days there was just undulating from one side of the country to the other in some fairly unremarkable places. And I get to the end of the day and discover that I'd done, you know, 10,000 feet of climbing or something. It's just cumulative.
If you had to revisit any of the routes from west to east, which one would it be?
That's a really tough question. There are many. One that does stand out for me, I think we had perfect weather. I had company. It was just everything about it was right. Was the one that actually began on the Isle of Man. So that would be map 95, where I'd never been before. So I guess I got the thrill of riding the ferries, and I got the excitement of going to not just a new place, but technically a new territory. It wasn't England. It wasn't Wales. It wasn't Scotland. Place I'd seen across the sea before, but never actually been on. And it turned out to be the most wonderful place to cycle in September. Just magical. And then I was met off the ferry, basically, by a friend who I live near and cycle with a lot. And he shared the next 3 days with me going across to Flamborough Head through some of what must be the most wonderful country in the world. And I say this as a Yorkshireman, but, you know, we went through the southern part of the Lake District, and then we went through the Yorkshire Dales up Dentdale and Wensleydale, and then across the Wolds, and the weather was perfect. It was, you know, if I could do that again tomorrow, I would, absolutely. But there were others.
Did you follow the Way of the Roses?
No. No, I mean, I dare say we crossed it at some point, but not specifically. We did what seemed right and, you know, again, followed the usual guidelines of taking the quiet roads and getting there reasonably directly. And it was very much my route. I never felt a need to define it any other way.
Mm. If Ordnance Survey came to you and said, Mark, we're thinking of redesigning or reorganising the maps and improving them and putting them perhaps in a different place, and we might just kind of shift a few around and just to make life a bit more kind of a bit more user-friendly.
Yeah.
Which map would you recommend that they renumber or move or change? What would be your piece of advice to them?
Right. Well, there's a couple that I would mention. Maps 11 and 12 are almost exactly the same as each other, and I don't know why.
Right, okay, yeah, I'm looking at it now. So that's in the top northeast of Scotland. Yeah, you're right. They're kind of, yeah, they're sitting almost on top of each other, yeah.
I can't imagine why you would buy both of them, really. So that was one. And then from a numbering perspective, there's a strange thing that happens in East Anglia. So if you find map 144,
yeah,
which sits right in the middle of Norfolk,
mm-hmm.
You'll find that map 145 is not next to it. Hmm. You would expect it, like every other coast-to-coast, to reach the sea, but this one stops and has above it to the right 134 and below it to the right 156. And I'd like them to fix that. It used to drive my wife mad. All they need to do is just stop the row above at 133 and then start 134 in Wales.
Yes.
And then allow what is currently 134 to be the end of the next row, and none of that would be necessary. So I think, you know, it just feels wrong.
There must be in Ordnance Survey headquarters, in their archive, there must be a rule book, a bit like the map of the London Underground. And the beauty of it, the map of the London Underground, the beauty is that they've always stuck to the same rules that were originally set out in terms of the direction of the lines and how things are recorded on the map. I reckon there's probably a rule book that they've got to follow as to where the maps are and how they number them exactly. But you're right, that is a little bit of an anomaly, isn't it? Number 144. They could almost come up with 144 A and B.
It's a one-off, and it never made sense to me, and I could live with that, but my wife really got angry about it.
We're getting towards the end now, don't worry. But this is fascinating. Usually when I do these things, I've usually on my other screen here, I've got websites and maps and, you know, social media accounts, and I kind of look at everything while I'm doing it, and it's a bit of a job doing it. But for the past 50 minutes, I've literally just stared at one piece of information, which is that overview map that hopefully people listening to this are also staring at. Otherwise, a lot of what we said, like I said earlier, won't make much sense. What I've also got in front of me is the map of the 470 Explorer maps, the 1 to 25,000 scale maps, which again, across the whole of the, well, not quite the UK, because it's again mainland Britain, although looking at it, it doesn't look as though they've included the Isle of Man, interestingly. How about doing those next?
That can be somebody else's adventure. I think maybe I've thrown down the gauntlet and someone else can pick that one up. I should point out that that would obviously be twice as long, because there's twice as many maps, because each one is only half as tall. So, you know, there is that. It's also bottom to top, isn't it, rather than top to bottom, I think.
Actually, the more I look at it, the more complicated it is, because the numbering, number one is actually, well, very close to where you are. That looks to me like the Peak District, number one. And then they actually start on the Isles of Scilly as number 101. They do work from west to east.
Yeah.
But they start in the south and then finish in the north as well. So it would be you'd be working your way north rather than working your way south.
I'm sure it would be an absolutely fascinating thing to do. And you'd see even more of the country than I saw, wouldn't you? You'd see twice as much. So, you know, I mean, it's there to be done. I don't personally feel the need to do any more of the nature that I've got under my belt. I think that was enough. And, you know, my next trip will be of a different kind, probably. But it is a question I've been asked before. And I think the numbering system's a bit complicated, because I don't think it came about the same way. And so when they started publishing those 1 to 25,000 maps, I think they started with the national parks. Possibly the Peak District was chosen as number one. And then, you know, and then they had the problem of how do you go back and retrofill it. So
yeah,
maybe that explains that.
I'm looking for number two. I can't find number. Oh, number two. There it is. It's, well, that looks like it's not too far from me. That looks like it's the Southern Yorkshire Dales by the looks of it. Number two. And then number three. Can't find number three. Then four, five, six and seven are the Lake District.
So it's a different beast and a different challenge for someone to do, but not me.
Yeah, you might. I mean, you might find, should you have the time or the inclination, and you probably don't have either, you could actually just go through and see which ones you did actually pass through, because I would imagine probably the vast majority you did actually pass through on your trips from west to east.
That's a good question. Maybe I'll do that one day. I never have, and it would be interesting to see which ones I missed.
You mentioned Ireland earlier, and potentially that would make another interesting trip, a bit shorter. Do you think it would work in other countries?
I think you'd have to find out what the map situation is in other countries. I don't see why not, in theory. I mean, you've got the constraints around size, obviously. Having just been in South America and countries like Argentina, you know, I mean, the scale is entirely different. So I think to attempt something similar to what I did there might be just too big and probably pointless, because I think you'd be going through a lot of empty space that looked the same as where you'd just been. One of the delightful things about the journey that the maps gave me in Britain was that every map was different. And every part of the country is worth seeing in its own right. There was no repetition. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about this island that we live on. You know, it's the endless variety and the fact that there's something of interest wherever you go.
Okay, well, I think on that point, it makes a perfect time to finish. So thank you for talking. And wherever you happen to go next, good luck. Pick a small country, Luxembourg, perhaps. That's probably just one map. Okay, right. Thanks for talking.
You're very welcome. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, thank you to Mark for that. Very often when those recordings take place, I stop recording and then continue to have a conversation with the person I've been speaking to. And I wish I'd kept recording after we finished our conversation, because we then went on and had a really interesting conversation about maps in general and how people in the cycling world either are still using paper maps or not. And also the attitude to maps more generally in society. I mentioned to Mark that it used to be the case 15, 20 years ago that every single child in the country, when they went to secondary school and they were in year seven, the old first year, they were actually given a copy of the local ordnance survey map for where they lived or the school where they attended. And I thought it was fantastic. The problem is a lot of them ended up in the bin, fair enough, which is presumably why they stopped giving the free maps out. But, you know, in every class of 30 children, if two or three of them actually kept and treasured that map, and then it led on to more adventurous lives in the future, then so be it. I think it was probably a price worth paying. Anyway, I didn't record the chat afterwards, which is a shame. But anyway, there we go. Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. I'll be back with episode 72 very soon, and that will probably be, again, me reading more from my first book, Crossing Europe on a Bike Called Reggie. On the subject of reading things, you can actually read an article that's been written by Mark if you go back and look at the current edition of Cycle Magazine. That's the magazine that you get free if you're a member of Cycling UK. And he's written about his journey in the April-May edition of that particular magazine. It's the Great Rights section in the middle. And if you are a member of Cycling UK, and if you do get that magazine free every month, then look out for the June-July edition of the magazine, because you'll find an article written by me all about my own great ride. That was obviously from Rotterdam back to Rotterdam on a 5,000-kilometre loop through mainly France and Switzerland and Germany in the summer of 2022. So that's it for episode 71. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by going to cyclingeurope.org/support, and you'll find all the details as to how you can do that. Thank you to the many people who have done that in the past and who continue to do it. And if you want to get in contact, perhaps with your own great ride, then please do so. The contact details are at cyclingeurope.org/contact, and social media at Cycling Europe. You can find me there as well. So until episode 72 of the Cycling Europe podcast, thank you for listening and happy cycling.